Welcome to Pax Europiana, and I'm happy to continue with this EU history, the enlargement history. Now we will discuss from the moment of 12, how we became 15 countries. That's about the neutral enlargement. To keep the context going, I would like to draw your attention again on the southern enlargement from 9 to 12. This was with including Greece, Spain and Portugal. Portugal and Greece already NATO members, Portugal from the beginning, and Greece from 52 together with Turkey as a response to the Strait crisis and to the Korean War and to the internal civil war which America has won for the conservative side in Greece. And then we had this, of course, the sclerosis of Franco. After his death and also the death of Salazar in Portugal, the gradual democratization in the 70s of these two countries in the Iberian Peninsula, and then the democratization and the transformation of all three countries very fast to get them in the European Union, in the European communities, in order to win the Cold War from the prosperity side as well, and make sure that these three countries are developing. As I've outlined, this was a much more positive phase, and the membership of the Cold War in the 80s and the membership of these three countries has contributed very much in the fact that we won the Cold War. It is very strategic and important countries, and they developed very well in that period of the 80s. Obviously from adjunct poverty, and they developed into reasonable, decent places. And now it's wonderful places to live and to work and to... you are very lucky if you are Spanish and Portuguese and Greek from today's perspective. No, that was never the case in the past. And so I would like to draw also the attention that in the 80s, the whole Cold War confrontation, obviously the first term of Ronald Reagan was still dominated by the Cold War. In the second term after 84, and then also the oil glut and all these factors, of course the West was winning the Cold War already dynamically. Nobody knew it will go so fast that really the collapse will come in 89, 91. There were many factors. I have discussed several of them already, like the oil glut, the arms race, the decline of the Soviet economy, and also the internal power struggle towards the direction. Should there be this kind of force used against Eastern Europeans, like the Chinese used against the citizens, and so many of these issues, they were definitely decisive. But the most important fact was obviously that we got our institutional and economic act together under Ronald Reagan, and also in Europe, obviously, Maggie Thatcher. But the key decisions were taken in the year, in the years after the Ronald Reagan was elected. He was elected in 80, and it's not a surprise in 81, Greece in the European Union. Maybe he has inherited that already from Carter. I don't want to attribute all the good things to Reagan, but obviously he was lifting the spirits, he was giving America the dynamic to win this Cold War again, and so it did. And then the 82 referendum won for NATO membership in Spain, and also then the two countries joining in 86. That was, of course, when you see the map of Europe, this is very strategic countries dominating the Mediterranean in the east and the west, and so the whole conditions for Europe got much better, and this was really decisive. And so we entered the second part of this winning phase, the end run of the Cold War, with Gorbachev in power in the Soviet Union, his effort also to seek some relief from the arms race, and also to give some democratization, I wouldn't call it. He wanted to be, in a way, in the socialist spectrum, less Leninist. He wanted to be in a direction, whatever, there was this social revolutionaries, probably this one, definitely authoritarian socialism, but less brutal and more like Khrushchev, probably. He was not a Democrat, let's not fool ourselves. And it was also very bloody, and it was less bloody, obviously. We were very lucky in Eastern Europe, but there were many, many crises, armed crises in the Soviet Union, in Lithuania, in Latvia, in Azerbaijan, in Georgia, and we tend to forget that because Gobi is of course very popular. And you know, on the bigger things, it's of course great that he self-destructed and dissolved the Soviet Union in his efforts to reform it. But let's never forget, it was a bloody dissolution of the Soviet Union. It didn't lead to the big civil war or to the big confrontation with the West, and we can be very lucky about, but it was bloody enough. And so let's shed no tears for the Soviet Union at all. It was an evil empire, and it dissolved, luckily, in these years. And who would have expected it in 86, 87, 88? But it was this eternal, amazing optimism, the performance of the Eastern, of the Western German economy, and of America, obviously, and of Japan, which economically outperformed the Soviet Union. And that was one of the keys, and also so many factors at once, which I have discussed in the history of the Cold War. What I want to say now, we were basically 9 at the moment, then we got 12. And so in this constellation of European Union of 12, we basically smoothed into these years of 88, 89, 90. And obviously it was then possible to see what kind of post-Cold War order should there be done. And here it's very important to understand that we had, of course, a Treaty of Paris, but the real peace treaty, I would call the more decisive one, was the Treaty of the European Union, the so-called Maastricht Treaty. That was in 92, and it was already 91, 92, and this was already making all the arrangements necessary for German unity, for the integration of Central Europe, and also for the euro, and also to pave the way for the neutral enlargement. Because in this decisive period of in the winning of the Cold War, and you know, the decision makers, they were Cold Warriors, Cold War Warriors, Helmut Kohl, and also Bush father, the first Bush, and also, of course, Clinton not, but the key decision makers, they were in that generation, and you don't change your political attitudes. They were themselves surprised after being steeled in the Cold War confrontation. They were themselves surprised what was possible suddenly, historic German unity, historic end of the Warsaw Pact, dissolution of the Soviet Union at the end of 91, and independence of Ukraine. I mean, this was all people who knew history really well. They knew all the things, and they, Helmut Kohl himself especially, but also the older Bush president. They knew how historic this window of opportunity was, and so they agreed to open up the European Union and NATO for the countries of the newly free countries. And also, what is important for our debate here, they knew the history of Sweden, of Austria and Finland, and also of Norway. But what was basically the opportunity here? That this neutral belt, which Stalin designed as one of his strategies, yeah, to have a neutral belt, that was the idea, neutralization of Germany completely in exchange for unity, that was his offer, in order to undermine the idea of BRD, of Western Germany, to join NATO in 55, and also neutralization of Austria. In that case, the Austrian model was basically a test case for Western Germany, and the reason why it was also accepted was very much the idea to make the pressure on Adenauer not to sign the NATO membership and lead his country not fully into the West, yeah, and have this neutral belt from Sweden, Finland, a united neutral Germany somewhere in the middle to Austria, of course, to understand as well Yugoslavia. Of course, there was a split in 48 between Tito and Stalin, but the idea was that this is ultimately turned out to be an American socialist client state, something very bizarre, and it ended also very tragically. But in the Cold War, it was Yugoslavia, American-funded, neutral, more or less neutral, socialist, bloc-free country. It was very bizarre. And then, obviously, then Greece, and then to have this neutral belt. It didn't work fully, but that was the concept. And these leftovers of the neutral belt strategy of Stalin in Sweden, Finland and Austria had now this historic chance when the Cold War was over, the Soviet Union gone, and Austria took really great effort that Russia is not the successor power in the Austrian state treaty, which the Soviet Union was. Yeah, it was really very difficult diplomatically, but our leadership, Alois Mock, he greatly took care that there might not be any legal kind of connection with the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation in relation to the Austrian state treaty, because he already understood there is now this historic opportunities window to complete or to lead Austria into the European Union. And it has also to be understood that Helmut Kohl, he was very much aware how could, you know, maybe there will be a backlash, which ultimately came when Putin came in power in 2099. But, you know, they were all unaware of the future. They were decision makers in their point. And then they said, look, NATO is too complicated for Austria. There will be no political support in the elite and also in the population. For Finland, the same, and for Sweden. So let's get them into the EU in that context in order to have them securely part of the West. And then we make the EU stronger. And so we at least have three important neutral countries additionally in the Western structures. And so it happened. Of course, you know, in the case of Norway, the referendum was lost. Maybe logically, actually, because of the strong connection with the United Kingdom, Norway should have joined already when Denmark joined in that, and also Iceland. But okay, that opportunity was lost in the 70s. Norway is simply such a super rich country with all these mineral resources and all these hydropower resources and all this amazing nature and the opportunities attached it has inherited. So there was a no in Norway, but there was a yes in Sweden, and there was a yes in Finland, and there was a yes in Austria in the referendums of 94. And see the cadence. The peace conference in Maastricht, after the breakdown of the Soviet Union 91, then Maastricht 2092, and then already 94 the referendums and all the attached decisions which had to be done. It was not one day you can join the European Union. It was a process. So this was really very much the fast track idea. Oh, amazing. It's over with the Soviet threat for now. Who knows what the future of Russia will be? Let's get these neutrals in, and so they came in the European Union. It led, overall, it's a wonderful and positive development for all Europe. Also, Austria is an important country. Also, Sweden is an important country. Also, Finland. It's almost together 25 million people. But obviously, it led also to a little bit more complicated European NATO relation, because up to then it was only Ireland which was neutral, sweeping in 73. But then now it was four neutrals, all with very specific political cultures towards Russia and the Soviet Union. It has to be understood that these border countries, Austria was a border country towards Eastern Europe with Slovakia, Czechoslovakia and Hungary and also Yugoslavia, and it was a very sensitive area, obviously. And Finland has a long, huge border with the Soviet Union and and Russia now today. So ultimately, these were very complicated geostrategic contexts. And during the Cold War, these were the border countries. Yeah, you can of course make degrees how much, in a way, neutrality Austria was and Sweden and Finland, because when you see the varying degrees how these countries were organizing themselves in the Cold War. Obviously, Sweden is the only country with a long-standing neutral tradition since the Vienna Congress after the Napoleon Wars. Yeah, and so Sweden was always a Western country in all extent and purposes, a market economy and politically close in philosophy and in links to the United States and to England. Yeah, whenever it was neutral in the Second World War, it was a free country, and it always stayed like this. Yeah? It was during the Cold War very much linked to Western Germany and, of course, to America and the UK. Also, Austria was a free country and a democracy, but it was with these border conditions and the mentality of the Austrian politicians and the fact that for 10 years Austria was partly occupied by the Soviet Union, and also the fragility of this situation in Budapest 56, the crackdown in 68, the Czechoslovakian crackdown. You cannot believe what kind of shocks that were. The Russian tanks cracking down in Budapest, 200 kilometers from Vienna, and then 300 kilometers north, it's Prague, and the crackdown there. It was dramatically complicated for the Austrian leadership at this time. Austria obviously was, I think also informally, you can say, a Western ally in the system. It was a mostly open economy. Whenever I call Austrian economic style of these years, mostly a kind of northern Yugoslavian experiment between somehow market economy and socialist participatory economy in a sense. Yeah. So that was a mixed system almost, I would call it. But it was mostly free. And it was, of course, in a way, always clear that the Americans somehow might protect us in case of a confrontation, whenever the protection would have been, maybe also including, tragically, I can go in the Austrian defense doctrine. I was also educated as an officer of the Austrian army, but I can do a separate one about Austrian neutrality. In this one, I want to talk about this complicated situation and the historic opportunity to get these free neutrals in. Yeah. Austria did it under great leadership and in a historic opportunity. I want to also mention that Germany was very much supportive of that. France was not supportive. And when you look back in the history of all the enlargements we had, you know, I talked already about De Gaulle stopping England two times, and it took him not being in the French presidency anymore to get this enlargement. I talked also that the French were very skeptical about Southern European enlargement, and they were not surprisingly also very skeptical about the enlargement of Austria, Finland and Sweden. Always, you know, you can find arguments. If you're in Paris, you always can find arguments. And if you're unchecked by American power, the French will always oppose enlargement, even from Austria, a country which basically they created in the peace treaty 1919. So they didn't want us in the European Union. We have not forgotten in Austria, and we hope for that the Americans have also not forgotten us, and that the Americans, thanks a lot, America and Germany, for including us in the European Union and for liberating and securing us in all the times before. So let's not be too anti-French, yeah, because I also love France and everybody. But the illusion that any country will join the European Union with French support and French help is absolutely illusionary. It must be America, and America and Germany must secure countries in NATO and in the EU. And with the French, if you leave Europe to the French, you will definitely not have any new country. And by time, we will also fall apart. If you see also the British Brexit, quite a lot of the British reasons have been connected with Europe left alone to the Europeans, and then France getting a bigger position, and then it's more and more unacceptable for the British. Yeah. It's not the only reason, but it's quite a big one. Good. So three more countries. Let me also talk about Finland. Finland was a bit of a different case in the Cold War. It was, of course, a democracy and a market economy, but the foreign policy of Finland, due to its geography and to the aggressive nature of the Soviet Union in the first decades of the Cold War, until the mid-80s, yeah, let's not forget what long period that was. So the so-called Finlandization. That means the Finnish don't like this term. It was a survival strategy in a difficult circumstances. Finland, and the Russians have not forgotten it, and the Finns have not forgotten it. Finland was part of the Russian Empire until 1917, when the Russian Empire broke, and they were also an autonomous region already then, and they tried to run away successfully in one civil war. The Russians came back in 40. And the next civil war, Russian war, and so on and so on. It was very complicated to break away from Russia long term. And the survival strategy then, when the Soviet Union was so powerful a neighbor, was obviously to be extremely nice to the Soviet Union. Now, of course, nobody in the West liked that very much, but for the Finnish, it was the right strategy. Similar, also like Austrian neutrality, was possible the best strategy to get unity, the only strategy to get unity. And then to be nice to the Soviet Union was also for the small border countries squeezed between East and West, yeah, who really had no chance to fully join the West. That would have been impossible in the power constellations of the West and the East at, during the Cold War. So they did this kind of policy. You can reproach it, but it's not justified out of the historic context. They had to do that. Maybe sometime they overdid it. And I'm sure many Finnish would be ashamed reading the texts of some of their leaders and journalists in the 60s and 70s. But, you know, the same is now for me. I'm also thinking that we did too much complicity with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But given the context of this huge nuclear armed, brutal Soviet Union cracking down in Budapest, in Prague, using force in Western, in Eastern Germany, in Poland and elsewhere, and the elites in Germany, Austria, and in Finland, you can be sure about it, followed each of these steps as it happened in the moment, and they were shivering with fear, and quite justified so. Because America is far away, whenever America would ultimately have defended many of the, for sure, the allies. But is Finland and Austria an ally, or is it like Ukraine today, a pro-Western country after 2014? But it would have been no problem for the Soviet Union to reoccupy Eastern Austria, and nobody would have defended us. And also it would have been no problem to take more territory from Finland for the Soviet Union, and there would not have been a World War III for that one. And so they knew it, and they behaved like this. Once this kind of terrible threat was in chaos, in a way, and falling, then obviously this was the right decision to do it. And the courage of all the decision makers and the wisdom has to be applauded. And so we became 15 countries in this amazing year of 95. And it is a historic achievement. It has made also the geographic unity, this idea of a neutral belt, yeah, it had made it obsolete, and also because of the mutual defense assistance clause, which also the EU has. And so we have basically got much further towards unity. We have not completed unity insofar that then after there was first the Bosnian War, and that is also very important to understand in the Austrian context, obviously, because Austria was seeing also this escalation of violence in Yugoslavia, helpless, but we helped a lot, but we could really not do something. So that has also focused, I think, a lot of minds in Austria to vote for yes for the European Union and not for somehow being safer and more united with the rest of free Europe when you see the chaos and the war and the destruction Serbia brought upon Slovenia, Croatia, and also Bosnia. Obviously, in 1999, the Western intervention was less popular in Austria, and that was also maybe one of the reasons NATO membership was not on the agenda. We are always in this kind of neutralism, equidistance, morally. We try to somehow be with the underdog, even when it's a brutal dictatorship on an aggressive spree, like Milosevic. And there were even some Austrians being complicit in these crimes, at least defending him. The most terrible is this kind of Nobel Prize winner, Mr. Handke. I think very abhorrent personality. Anyhow, I digress into Austrian politics. I want to stay on this EU enlargement track. Austria joined, Finland did the same, and Sweden did the same. And it was historic, not only for us in 25 million, and also for EU being 15, but it opened also the way then for the next wave of enlargement, which obviously took some time. First NATO enlargement with Poland, with Hungary, and with Czech Republic in 99, and that was obviously very historic. and obviously had also an effect on the Russian internal politics, because Poland is another country they historically dominated, and then they lost it forever to NATO. Obviously, that was, in their thinking, a big shock and one of the reasons for the counter-reaction which led to Putin. Doesn't say that we should not have taken, by accepted and invited Poland. On the contrary, all countries have to decide their own future. But it has an effect on Russia. Anyhow, it was more or less an internal power struggle in Russia, and they found a lot of additional arguments justify their own greed. But it had an effect, there's no doubt there. And then in 2000, we had this big enlargement round, which I will talk in the next series about, which, of course, NATO enlargement and EU enlargement together, 7 new countries in NATO and 10 new countries in the European Union. And then we had the attached enlargement rounds later for Southeastern European countries, which gradually came in. And you will not be surprised by me saying that there was a lot of American support for these enlargements and for the next enlargement, and we need a lot of American support together with Germany for the next enlargement to include Ukraine and all Balkans in NATO and EU. So that's more or less the short story. In just half an hour, I want to keep the series like this, how we really, from the terrible 70s, where the West was in retreat and defeat, towards the time under Reagan, with Reagan as the leader, who really brought this optimism back, this decisive southern European enlargement, which contributed, I think, significantly to more security and prosperity in southern Europe, in the Mediterranean theater, and leading then, among many other factors, to victory in the Cold War, and then allowing the neutral enlargement fast track to happen into the European Union, which made it so much more feasible to have then the enlargement of the new countries because of all the institutional preparations in Maastricht and also the possibility of the Soviet Union basically no longer being an opponent. And this one led then to the possibility to unite Europe in 2004, the big and decisive year about which I will talk in the next podcast, which I will publish soon. So I have to close. You know, this was 25 years ago, where Austria, Finland and Sweden have joined EU. And we have a mutual assistance agreement between the EU and NATO. And it's Article 42 in NATO, and it's Article 5, Article 42 in the EU treaties, it's Article 5 in NATO treaty. So there is no logical reason for Austria, Finland and Sweden to stay neutral and not join NATO anymore. You know, it's, so did I say that right? In a short version, we took, under this historic window of opportunities, these 3 countries, thanks a lot. Austria, Finland, Sweden became EU members in 1995. Now, in the year 2020s, it's very important for Finland, for Sweden, for Austria to join NATO, to show more solidarity in the Second Cold War with the rest of the NATO allies, which are all NATO and EU members. 93% of all EU citizens are NATO members. We just have these 3 countries, which in 1993 were very lucky to join very fast. And of course, small Ireland, Cyprus and Malta. I will talk in the next series about them. But these 3 countries who were so lucky 25 years, 26 years ago to move into this European Union in the geostrategic historic context of the fall of the Soviet Union, they absolutely should feel the decency and the moral obligation of solidarity in the European Union, where they profited so much and where they are so secure now, that also they put the moral leadership forward to join NATO fully, be also officially an ally of Canada and of the United States of America, and be invited by Joe Biden now to join, and so complete the westward integration fully. Because the Soviet Union is different, it's gone. The Russian Federation is a complicated country, but it's not so powerful as the Soviet Union, so there is no threat level. Anyhow, you are all in the European Union, so there is mutual assistance and obligation to defend each other already agreed. And it's just laziness of the politicians. And it's also a kind of anti-American cover and a kind of cheap populism not to join NATO. Because we are anyhow united. And you just somehow then do this kind of peace dialogue, which as if NATO would not be a defensive alliance. We are not an aggressive alliance. We are a defensive alliance. So get your act together, Austria, Sweden and Finland. And join NATO now until 2024 during the Biden presidency, which is a similar kind of a historic opportunity. And get this done now and complete your Western journey, your integration into the Western structure. Complete it by joining NATO. And I call on all Swedish and Finnish executives, leaders, civil servants, and the Austrians, yeah. You were very lucky in 91-92. We all were. You moved into the European Union, but it was not under the condition that you somehow changed the European Union towards a more neutral kind of third wave, Yugoslavian Tito-style kind of experiment and support some kind of French anti-Americanism with that one. It was the American and Germans who, in wisdom, have fast-tracked your integration. And now it's really important to complete this journey towards the West. Austria, Finland, Sweden, join NATO now and make sure the instruments of accession are in the US Senate ratified fully by 2024, because you never know who will be the next American president, and maybe an orange clown will come back. Yeah? And let's not waste this opportunity with the most pro-European American president, yeah? Who will get this majority in the Senate done. So please, yeah, Mrs. Marine Sanna and Mr. Löwen and Mr. Kurz, lead your nations into NATO. Thanks a lot.